As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Chisel and marble at Princeton a few years ago, and Jean Bavin joins us today. What was it like to go in front of your PhD advisors at Princeton? Who were those guys?
Ben Bernanke, Michael Woodford, Mark Watson. Mark Watson was my main advisor. That was a great moment. I would not have remembered the title if you had not said it, so thanks for bringing that up.
No, it's very, very cool. I mean, to have Bernanke moving one way on economics and Michael Woodford with the mathematics on the other side must have been intimidating. Is that kind of brain power going to show itself at Jackson Hole this year? Are we going to dovetail the mathematics of Woodford with the more holistic economics of Bernanke at Jackson Hole, Jean?
Interesting. To be honest, we're kind of wondering what will really happen there. Our view is that there's maybe too much hope that this is going to be a policy signaling exercise, especially around the taper. So I think this might be a disappointment and maybe returning more to hardcore kind of like academic input to policy making, like that used to be the case, maybe with the hiatus last year with the framework review.
Jean, based on your tenure at the Bank of Canada, based on your experience with central bankers and having them as colleagues, do you think that they're concerned by how much control they have or perceived control by markets over not only benchmark rates, but just risk appetite in general?
Concerned, I'm thinking they're pretty aware of, central banking has been in the front stage since 2008. We only game in town. So I think they've gotten used to the attention and the center role that they're playing. I think this is evolving, though. And in our view, like fiscal policy is now taking the baton from them, will be more so going forward. So I think we're kind of at the juncture where things are changing a bit. But I think their concern is probably more about like how they communicate around the current situation. I think the potential for mistake is pretty high. We've seen it. I think we're losing a bit of a long-term anchor on 10-year yields, for instance. And I think this is largely due to uncertainty around the central bank outlook.
We're losing a long-term anchor on 10-year yields. Elaborate, please. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think when you look at the price movement from the last 2 months, right, we went from pricing inflation fears with 10-year yields that were on the way up to what we see now is a complete disconnect between the macro outlook and the movement we've seen in yields. Various explanations for that, technicals and so on, but I think one of them is a big debate around what the central bank is actually doing. Markets trying to digest that, the new framework, and I think that's part of the story there.
Jean, I look at the entire economics right now, and the word that we keep talking about here between John, Lisa, and me, and we make jokes about it, but it's really serious microeconomic foundations, which is the ambiguity of what's going to happen. Given a given thrust in inflation, what's the key ambiguity of which way the financial system cuts given higher inflation? What's the key mystery?
Well, I think Tom, this is exactly what I think is very unusual about the current situation is that the range of outcome that we are contemplating collectively, be it on inflation, be it on what the central banks will be doing, be it even on growth, what is it, a restart, is it the beginning of a longer kind of expansion? This is a pretty wide range of outcome, and I think the markets in those environments tend to interpret the news flow and then go from one kind of potential outcome to the other. And these are more like binary kind of outcome, and that creates like the volatility we're seeing. I think where there's consensus is that this is a pretty constructive environment for risk. We're seeing that in equities, of course. We are pro-risk. We are lucky to be pro-risk at this stage. So that is kind of consensus. But from here, on an unusually wide range, and I think we're facing binary outcomes.
John Farrow has led our discussion here of stock and flow. And I would suggest when we look at the debt, the deficit is a static object. It's a bathtub that's the size of an Olympic pool. Should we be worried about the stocks, the size of the pool that's built up of these things we worry about?
Yeah, I think there's been we've left the stock a bit out of the picture. But like if you just take a step back and look since COVID, the amount of spending that has been like put on the table, including with the infrastructure bill this week and the reconciliation we're going to see going forward. We're talking about like amounting a total of 43% of GDP in new spending that we didn't have pre-COVID. That's a large amount. That's your stock point. We are comfortable or pretty relaxed about this given the rate outlook we're seeing. But I think we're much more now subject and we're facing a fragile environment where if there are adjustment in rates, it's going to be a lot more disruptive with the stock. Much larger now.
Jean, before we let you go, Dean Kernit on the show earlier said that the inflation is contained is the same as subprime is contained of today. That basically this is a faith-based assertion that is yet to be proven and it really goes to your call about the question marks underpinning where Treasury yields are today. Do you agree that inflation is controlled is the same kind of view as subprime is contained of 2007, 2006?
Yeah, I think it's even more than subprime because inflation is, in my view, in our view, a purely self-fulfilling phenomenon ultimately. So it's what we believe or markets believe it to be. And I think we are seeing the elements for inflation to break out to our level. We think it's going to be contained ultimately. That's still like kind of our baseline. But that's not a given. That's far from a given. An episode in the past where inflation got out of hand, I mean, were not expected, before they happened. So I think that's a fair. I would have sympathy for that point, and I think this is underappreciated as a risk.
Jean Bovin, thank you so much. Greatly, greatly appreciate it this morning with BlackRock. There, really, really informed discussion there, folks, and some of the dynamics that we see right now.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources, from clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs. To ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Dean Cutter, a macro risk advisor, founder and CEO. Dean, the complacency of us to start a program like we have done, start this hour like we just have, look through all-time highs, 47 of them year-to-date on the S&P 500, and it just seems to me that we're numb. We're numb to any incoming information that tells you otherwise about this bullish story you've created. What does that tell you, Dean?
Well, I like the Field of Dreams exercise. I think it's interesting to take a movie and kind of make it into real life. But I also, in terms of markets, I like taking real events and looking back on them. And it is 10 years to the week that the, I would call it the joint crisis between the Eurozone sovereign episode of 2011 and the US debt ceiling showdown occurred. And for the week of this week, 10 years ago, realized volatility in the S&P was 90%. This week, realized volatility in the S&P is 3.5%. So it just goes to show you the extent to which markets can go from extremely high levels of volatility to, as you're discussing, something that really is a snooze fest. And I think the important part about the snooze fest is it really dulls our imagination. It catches us, it causes us to be caught off guard. And of course, the linchpin of it all, I know you host your show, the Real Yield, there's not much of that
around these
days.
Yes, let's mention that, Dean. Nice of you to bring that up.
So everything is linked to a minus 1.1 to more negative 10-year yield. Everything, equity valuations, low levels of volatility. Mm-hmm. And I'm very concerned that we're trusting the central banks in a way that, history has proven unkind to that level of trust. I go back to, for example, the early 2007 period. And to me, subprime is contained, is the inflation is transitory of 2021. These epic misreads by central bankers shouldn't be forgotten. They can ultimately cause a lot of market harm.
Dean, I want to know where how VIX sets here. We had a VIX of 22, 21, whatever, back in mid-July, and down we go under 16 today. Tell me what the Greek letters say right now, the co-movements of the market say about the oomph to get the VIX down to a true bull market, 14, or dare I say 13.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, realized volatility around 3.5%. It's almost as if the S&P 500 is a pegged currency, right? And options on a peg are really not worth very much. And so the gravitational pull, as you call it, in the VIX is really contingent on not just this low level of volatility, realized volatility, but it's nearly ground to a screeching halt. So, you know, I had the VIX floored at around 17. Obviously, we've breached that. And what causes you to breach it is when you get such shockingly low levels of movement. It's the quiet. And a lot of folks had forecasted that there'd be some fireworks in August. That has been with some regularity a month where the summer vacation got disrupted. It doesn't look like, at least for now, that's going to happen right now. So, I think when I step back, I just try to look at risk reward. And you're right, the equity market's going up. It's not going up a ton. What I worry about is this degree of complacency that, again, it's grounded in the mispricing of nominal yields versus the rate of inflation. We're really hoping that inflation comes down. It's just very difficult to know. And the damage that could result should it not prove transitory and bond yields react ultimately and kind of push higher on a nominal level.
Dean, you're teasing us. I just want to get you to make the point. You said something that I will not let pass. You said that inflation is transitory, is the new subprime is contained. That's quite a call. So let's get the conviction call in this market, not the ifs, the buts on the one hand, on the other. What's the call?
I think the call is that the valuation argument that's being made in equities is contingent on something that we just have no idea around. And the data tells us, at least so far, that nominal yields are so far below the rate of inflation that the Fed could be in a very, very difficult spot. If we go back and look at all the risk offs that we've had, and you know, there have been some doozies along the way, the Fed's always been there to assuage the market and to lift it higher for a couple of reasons. One is that market risk and economic risk typically occur at the same time, right? They typically run into trouble at the same time. And so the Fed, in its remit to revive the economy, ultimately has these policies which work more directly on asset prices. But the bigger point, John, is that the Fed's air cover is always that the rate of inflation is below target. So it's allowed to do much. We're in a much different circumstance now. The rate of inflation is well above target. So if we do run into a risk off, we've got to be asking ourselves the question, what's the Fed going to do, just given that inflation's so far above target already?
Dean, so important. And I'm pleased we got you on the spot on that question. Dean Koenig there of Macro Risk Advisors, the founder and CEO. Tom, that line there, inflation is transitory, is the new subprime is contained. That's something to take note of. Well, let's get from New York to Wyoming and bring in Jill Mowak, the chief economist at AXA Investment Management. Jill, let's start there. August 26th. Because no one's really interested in August 13th this morning, it seems. Jills, let's start on August 26th. Jackson Hole, what are you looking for from the Fed chairman at that gathering?
I'd be surprised if we had a sort of formal announcement from them, or from him, actually, in Jackson Hole, because the last few years, quite a few years, actually, the Fed has tried to tone down the importance of Jackson Hole when it comes to actual policy announcements. It's a place where you debate, it's a place where you lay the ground for your future announcements, but you don't use it really to be too precise about what you want to do. So my guess is that we'll have a pretty consensual discussion from everybody from the Fed, making it clear that, hey, you know, we may still have some differences on the exact timing of when we taper, but tapering we will. And this is for the coming months, plural. As a Frenchman, I have trouble putting an S mm-hmm. after TH. So yeah, consensual, not a lot of conversations, of dissenters, I would say, because they're all moving in the same direction if you read yeah. the Fed speak. So probably not much suspense.
Jill, define data dependency for us. The theme at Jackson Hole is going to be waiting and waiting and waiting. Define this new data dependency of this new Fed.
Definitely, and I don't think that they can answer any precise question at this stage. Because on tapering, okay, it's a matter of months. On when they would fully normalize monetary policy, i.e. when they would actually start moving rates, they've given themselves a lot of leeway. And this is where I think they will have to learn by watching them and follow their stride. Because before the pandemic struck, honestly, there was no consensus on where the natural unemployment rate was in the U.S. There was no agreement on where the equilibrium interest rate was in the U.S. It's become even more unclear in this crisis. Well, so I think they will be extremely pragmatic, and there's, again, not much they can say at this stage on what they intend to do in the next 2-3 years.
Gilles, it's sort of shocking to me. We get equity analyst after equity analyst saying, buy this rally. Basically, it's going to keep going up. It's going to go up more than we had previously expected. We have pretty incredibly good data. We're coming out of the labor market, coming out of inflation, where, you know, if you want to see inflation, if you start to see recovery signs all over the place, why are economists not changing their projections after the past 2 weeks? Why is this transitory? Why does this fit into everybody's narrative on the economic side if it's not on the equity analyst side?
I think, well, economists usually try to focus on what the fundamentals are telling us and probably try to take on board what the impact of the beginning of the normalization of monetary policy will mean. At the moment, yes, you're right, the fundamentals are telling a great story, earnings are doing well, the economy is reopening at a fast clip, we were very worried about the Delta variant, but it seems that, you know, the capacity of the economy to deal with it is higher than we thought, higher than we feared. Still, there is an elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is, how is the market going to behave once we start losing this massive constant purchases of risk-free assets and not so risk-free assets from central banks? It's not for immediate consumption in Europe, which may explain why the equity market is doing even better in Europe right now. But in the US, it's a matter of months. So I guess most economists are trying to work the models and start to think, hey, you know, once I take out from the equation those billions of dollars of purchases, where should the market be? And, you know, this is probably what makes us a bit grumpy, but, you know, that probably comes with the trade.
Jill, how do you gauge that? Is that just a guess? How do you know how the market will respond? What do you look for?
Well, you can try actually to come up with you know, economic models which make sense, because we've had actually years and years now of experience of an increase in the size of central bank's balance sheet. We've had years of experience with QE. So you can actually, it's not that complicated, you can actually estimate the impact of a change in the balance sheet of the central bank on equity prices. That's not rocket science. The question, though, is that what is really complicated to estimate is the psychological impact. Yep. The fact that even if the central bank stops buying, and then the model is going to tell you, hey, you know, that means X percent less on the trajectory for risky assets. The problem is that now the market knows that if something goes wrong, central banks are going to act probably faster and in a bigger way than before. So that provides a sort of insurance, a sort of flooring to the market. And that's the bit that is really, really hard to estimate. But the direct impact, yes, you can, and there are lots of models which do that.
The conditioning, Jill, we've got to leave it there. Really great final thoughts. You're my work there of Axa Investment Management, the chief economist.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Dana Telsey, thank you so much for joining us today on the state of retail. What's the why behind your and Joe Feldman's enthusiasm? What's the oomph that's getting retail to the end of the year?
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me. I think the oomph that's getting retail to the end of the year, I think number one, it's the consumer, the dollars that they have, and the pent-up demand that they have for gathering and hopefully being together in a safe way if this variant can be controlled. I think the other thing is the innovation that companies have. More new product innovation, and not just in product, but think about also in transaction transformation, whether it's curbside, whether it's digital. The convenience that consumers have is greater right. than ever, and it's exciting.
What's the lesson learned from the pandemic on inventory management? That's so much part of the failure of margins. Is there something that carries over that they all learned about inventory?
Reduction in SKUs helps to drive profitability. Managing inventory is key. Can you do more with less? And can you personalize the offering so that you don't have an abundance of goods leading to markdowns? The headwind today is definitely supply chain and getting goods into the U.S. We hear that from company after company, and it doesn't seem like that's going to normalize before the end of the year. So we're going to have tight inventory levels as we go through the second half of the year.
How are companies dealing with that, the supply chain issues that they see persisting for a while?
Some of the different ways they're dealing with it, they're bringing goods in by air. It's not a cheap way to do things, but it helps to meet demand. And you'd rather not lose the sale and bring goods in that you can sell at a full price. Some of them are transitioning from the West Coast ports to the East Coast ports, but reduction in inventory and hopefully lower inventory levels than we had in the past will lead to a much more balanced promotional environment in the future.
As the Delta variant continues to spread, are people overestimating or underestimating the return of brick and mortar?
I think basically as the Delta variant spreads, we're continuing to see reopenings recover, physical store footprints encouraging, and traffic improving, but conversion is higher than traffic. Consumers are going with destinations in mind and picking up goods. There is certainly a concern that will traffic slow a bit if we see this Delta variant expand. But now companies know how to manufacture and to deliver the whole experience with omnichannel. That omnichannel customer mm-hmm. is more profitable than the single channel customer.
In big box, what's your single best buy, Dana, right now?
I mean, look what Target's doing. It's pretty special. And frankly, look what Walmart's doing. I think the big box discounters are capturing more consumers.
How long can this consumer boom continue, though, in terms of spending, given the fact that we are seeing prices rise and we are expecting some of the wage increases to start to slow?
So when we see the wage increases slow, and yes, prices are rising, we've heard about it in footwear, we've heard about it in other categories too, child tax credit's going to be there through the end of the year. And the savings rate is high. I think we're going to see a sustained demand of enhanced spending as we go through the Christmas time period.
Is where people are spending, is that changing? I know that we went through the cycle of devices, and then recently we've seen an explosion of people trying to buy clothes that fit them as they try to return to the office. Where are the hot spots right now heading into year end?
I think heading into the year end by category, I think apparel is a hot spot. The innovation that you have, whether it's denim, whether it is footwear, and frankly, look at luxury goods. The strength there has been quite solid. I think the other hot spots that we're going to be seeing out there, I mean, take a look at off-price. Off-price stores basically weren't open for a significant part of last year. They don't have the digital channel. We right. should be a benefit to that also.
Dana Telsey, one final question. You are a beast of Manhattan in New York City. We all drive around and see the empty stores. How do you react when you see empty stores on 2nd Avenue? On your Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue, or way over on, you know, the West Side? How do you respond to that?
It's depressing. I want to see life. I want to see stores coming back to Manhattan. We are seeing people come back to live in Manhattan. We've certainly seen an uptick in apartment sales. And the improvement in Madison Avenue, I'm hearing of an acceleration of some openings on Madison Avenue in this back half of the year. We need the vibrancy to come back to the neighborhoods, even in the Flatiron District. The Harry Potter store opened, but then you have so many closings elsewhere. Tourism will help to bring traffic, the return of work, even in a hybrid manner, and kids going to school.
Dana Telsey, thank you so much. Greatly, greatly appreciated, of course, the Telsey Advisory Group here at Update. Their enthusiasm for Mr. Feldman this morning on Walmart and on Target. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.